The Siege of New Hampshire series by Mick Rowland. Book 6, The Summer of Wood and Iron. Chapter 6, Coming to Terms.
You boys can ride in the back, said Farnham. He pointed to the luggage shelf of his one-horse buggy. Three waterproof suitcases were strapped tight to the back of the bench seat, leaving just enough room for Martin and Charles to sit facing backwards, legs dangling. Farnham took his seat beside his driver, a short man wearing a flat-brimmed straw hat.
My house is down that road, Charles pointed to the road across from Town Hall. Down that hill, then over the next.
The precarious seating reminded Martin of the early rides on the back of Jen's two-wheel trap. Martin studied the vehicle, looking for ideas that he and Carlos might incorporate into their next buckboard project. Farnham's rig wasn't a refurbished antique, but newer construction. The unsprung frame was made from bent wood that had a boat-like shape, square in the back, pointed in the front. The pivot for the front axle was at the prow. Easy clearances for the front wheels to turn and fewer joints to fuss over. Martin liked that. The wheels looked to be of the modern racing bicycle type, five wide carbon fiber spokes and thin rubber tires. They were sturdy enough for the light duty and had created less rolling resistance. The disc brakes were from bicycles and had a very modern touch. The buggy's sprung frame looked to be fabricated from aluminum tubing and thin plywood. The canopy had been a nylon window awning originally. Clear plastic curtains were rolled up and lashed around the perimeter. Farnham had himself an all-weather transport. As they swung out of the parking area and onto the road, the buggy waggled back and forth on its leaf springs. Martin and Charles' shoulders collided before they both held on tighter to the side rails. Farnham and his driver talked about their upcoming travel plans. Charles leaned close to whisper.
I'm liking this guy's thinking on building a larger economy. That's what we've been trying to do with our coastal runs, but bigger.
Oh, with all your new trailers, your operation will be bigger, said Martin.
Hey, yeah, Charles smiled, relishing the thought. I wonder what this Mr. Farnham has in mind.
Martin spoke softly, so the loud clip-clop of the hooves on pavement could mask his comments.
Jeff must have gotten him interested in your generator welder.
Charles could only shake his head and shrug. The ride down the hill was brisk. The horse got into a fast trot. The breeze from their speed felt refreshing. The cooling treat lasted only until the bottom of the hill. The horse slowed to a walk, then a plod, eventually stopping to toss her head and whinny in protest.
Four people in our gear is too much for her, said Farnham's driver.
Right, said Farnham.
Farnham climbed down to the road while speaking to his driver.
You take her up slow to the top. We'll walk up and meet you there.
He turned to Martin and Charles, who had also stepped off the buggy.
I'm afraid we'll have to walk to the top, gentlemen. A two-horse team could manage these hills, but would have required more upkeep than I had time for.
Well, that's fine, said Martin. We're used to walking.
The horse whinnied and resisted for a few moments before leaning into the collar and plodding up the hill. The driver had stepped down, too, to reduce the load that the horse had to pull up the hill. He walked ahead of the horse with a short lead on the bridle.
This will give us an opportunity to chat a bit, said Farnham. As I said during my little speech, I see our state stagnating, and yet on the brink of a brighter future.
Stagnating? Asked Martin. I think we're doing pretty well for ourselves, considering.
Oh, you folks in Cheshire are doing well, I'll admit, said Farnham with a nod. But from my recent tour, I can see that you are one of the exceptions to the norm. People survived this winter. Well, many did. And they are working to survive the next. But from what I see, many communities have set their sights too low. They seek only to amass sufficient to survive the next winter with less hardship.
Now, what's wrong with that? Objected Charles.
Survival? Oh, nothing. The problem is that they stop there. They have fallen into a sort of stasis, no longer trying to build, to grow, to improve. Many are settling for mere survival. This siege may not have worked as quickly as our would-be overlords had hoped, but I can see that it has sapped away much of that stalwart New Hampshire spirit to tame the wild woods, harness the rivers, to build something out of nothing, and once that first thing was built, to build a bigger and better something. No, my good fellows, I see the candle of Yankee spirit growing dim.
Well, I haven't seen this gloom you're talking about, said Martin. Oh, haven't you? Asked Charles. I think we do see some of that on our trips to the coast and back. Oh, sure, Hampton is a lively place now. But Charming Fair, Redmond, Exeter? If it wasn't for our stops to trade a little fish for this or that, oh, they'd be ghost towns.
Exactly, my good man, exactly. Your Mr. Landers has told me a bit about your entrepreneurial excursions. I had heard tales, bordering on the legendary, I dare say, of an operational truck doing business down here. I was delighted to learn that the legends were true. I have a great interest in such a vehicle.
Oh? Charles asked skeptically. Why, it's not for sale or anything, if that's what you're thinking.
Oh, no, no, my dear boy.
Farnham closed his eyes, raised one palm, and shook his head slightly, as if he were declining hors d'oeuvres.
I'm merely commenting on your spirit of growth and industry. That is the crucial spirit your fellow citizens have lost. That is precisely what the CRC will do, but on a grander scale. Local economies have ground to a crawl. They are settling for subsistence and survival, when a far better life is possible. The CRC is poised to provide that opportunity for growth, gentlemen. As I said, and you well know, everyone needs food and fuel. What this state needs is a vigorous trade in both. If you... I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Martin.
Right. If you, Martin, grew more crops than your family needed for the winter, you could trade them at our exchange for a cord of wood. Now, before you object, you don't have to keep and consume that cord. You could trade your wood with another man for his labor to, say, dig you one of those ponds I had heard about. Your surplus crops become, in effect, a pond. The cord of wood serves as a medium of exchange between you. Now, imagine your trade enacted 100-fold throughout the community, the improvements to people's lives and homes. Cords of wood will become the common barter item. Imagine the secondary and tertiary cottage businesses that can then begin to grow. With an outlet for people's surplus, there will be an incentive to create a surplus, to do more than simply subsist. That, gentlemen, is the missing drive our state needs. It is what our state needs to reverse the malaise our oppressors are hoping to sow.
The three men met up with the buggy at the top of the hill. The driver had a longish lead on the horse, so it could rip at the long grasses alongside the road. The ride down Stockman Hill was brisk and refreshing. The buggy's disc brakes squealed softly most of the way down.
That's my house over there, said Charles. The green one.
As the buggy crunched to a stop on the gravel driveway, the driver turned back to ask,
Could I get a few gallons of water?
Charles nodded and strode toward the barn. He returned with a 5-gallon pail, not quite full of water. The horse quickly thrust her nose into the bucket and began to drink, chomp splashing loudly. Charles pointed to a shady patch of lawn that the horse could graze upon while it rested.
"Our welder is around the side of the barn," said Charles. "We got some trailers we've been working on back there, too."
The three of them walked to the corner of the barn.
"Oh, my, it is larger than I had imagined. Your Mr. Landers underplayed your accomplishments. This looks amazing."
Martin and Charles smiled at each other, somewhat embarrassed at the praise.
"And what is this large accoutrement?"
Farnham patted the gasifier's hopper.
"That's the gasifier," said Martin. "It makes wood gas that powers the engine."
"Oh, have you operated it? Does it perform as impressively as it looks?"
"We've done some welding on some trailer frames," said Charles. "Here, I'll show you."
Martin hung back and let Charles give the tour. He walked Farnham over to one of the trailers.
See, we added this front pivot for the front axle and tongue. And then around back here, we've added a receiver for a hitch.
"Oh, this is perfect,"
Farnham muttered to himself as he ran his fingers gingerly over the new welds.
"A welder and a truck. This really is perfect."
He lingered, studying the various new welds. Charles drifted over to Martin to watch Farnham.
"I'm guessing he wants us to weld some stuff for him," whispered Charles.
"Us?
You mean you," Martin whispered back. "I've got a ton of stuff to do at home."
"Well, so do I," countered Charles. "But this guy's interested in a welder. A welder 100 miles away. He must need stuff welded pretty badly. Sounds like a business opportunity to me. Here he comes. Shh, play it cool."
"Well, boys, you have a fine rig here. You can be a blessing to thousands of your fellow Granite Staters, a legacy of kindness that will become part of New Hampshire history."
"Blessing? Kindness? Legacy?"
Those sounded to Martin like words associated with a charitable donation, and he was not feeling particularly charitable. Charles gave Martin a quick side eye with a squint. He had picked up on the donation speak, too.
Mr. Farnham, began Charles.
"Oh, call me C.T., said Farnham. "Clive Thomas Farnham."
He held out his hand for Charles to shake.
"My friends call me C.T.
C.T. We're pretty proud of our generator welder, but we are pretty busy with our own projects."
Martin could see Farnham's promoter's smile drop a bit when Charles said the word "but."
"Yeah, we still need to outfit these trailers to carry cargo," continued Charles, counting on his fingers, "and barter up loads of wood to carry to the coast for trade, hauling back the fish. We plan to stimulate the local economies with our own east-west road train. We probably will be a blessing to folks along the way. We're already part of New Hampshire history. Martin here is overseeing carriage making and constructing gasifiers so we can have a few more running vehicles."
"And we do still have our crops and animals to tend to," added Martin. Despite Farnham's frozen smile, his eyebrows drooped slightly. Beads of sweat seemed more obvious on his forehead.
It is a hot one today. Perhaps we could sit in the shade and discuss matters?"
"I guess so," said Charles. "We could all use a cool drink of water. Give me a hand with the pump and the bucket, Martin."
Sure. The two of them left Farnham sitting in the lawn chair beneath the oak tree. They rounded the corner of the house to the hand pump. Charles began working the lever up and down. The metal part squeaked with each stroke. Martin held the white plastic bucket under the spout.
"Why are you still entertaining this guy?" Martin asked. "You're already busy with your road train project, and I'm hip-deep in my own projects." "True, but..."
Charles spoke between downstrokes. Water began to pour from the spout.
"He must need this welding pretty badly if he's trying to talk us into helping."
"You keep saying us," Martin objected.
"I just said that I'm..." "I heard you. You know full well that our new rig is no one-man show. Now hold on.
Before you start throwing objections at me, hear me out. I think this Farnum needs us more than he wants to let on. We could bargain for a deal that's worth our time.
See, you're doing it again with the wee stuff. Charles rolled his eyes.
Let's take the bucket in the house and get some glasses.
They used the back door to get into the kitchen.
I keep saying we because you stand to benefit too. I'm thinking that we bargain for a cut of his hauls. Just like the deal that we have with you. You get your dividend fish from each run. If we can trade a day or so of welding for a regular supply of wood from up north, Tyler and I can trade all that wood for more fish and salt from the coast. You get more food and salt. You're investing in your family's future.
Martin sighed heavily as he poured the cold water into tall glasses. Martin prized salt highly, and Butch's sea salt was the only source of new salt thus far. Salt-cured fish was going to be a staple during the coming winter. He needed salt for making sauerkraut from his cabbages, a winter source of vitamin C. Salt-cured small game meat was time-shifted protein in jerky form. The future kept getting in the way of his present-day to-do list.
Okay, Martin said with resignation, but only if you can finagle a dividend deal. If he just wants to trade for a couple of cords of wood, then no deal. We can get that faster and easier right here.
Agreed.
Charles put on his disinterested face and pushed out the front door. Charles handed Farnum and his driver each a glass as he sat down on a cinder block.
As we were saying, C.T., your project sounds interesting and all, but we're all very busy down here.
Farnum leaned forward in his chair.
Oh, I do understand that. Everyone is busy. Each day of labor is a limited quantity, one which must be invested carefully. I do propose to compensate you for your time. I am prepared to offer you both a full cord of northern hardwood.
He sat back slowly with a smug sort of smile. His slow emphasis on full cord made it sound especially generous.
No, said Martin as he stood up. I gotta get going. Much to do. Nice to meet you, Mr. Farnum.
Charles, we'll talk later. Farnum looked dismayed, eyes darting between Martin and Charles.
Yeah, afraid I've got a lot to do today, too.
Charles stood and stretched.
Yeah, feel free to let your horse eat and drink or fill. I've got to get back to...
Two cords each.
Farnum leaned forward, nodding subtly. Martin exchanged a quick eye contact with Charles.
Look, Mr. Farnum, your CRC project sounds like a big deal, and you've even suggested some wages, but you haven't defined the scope of work. It sounds to me like a bottomless time sink that I can't afford to get stuck in.
Yeah, added Charles. Just what exactly are you wanting done? We'd have to know that before even thinking about any deals.
Okay, said Farnum with a sigh. Please, gentlemen, retake your seats.
He leaned back in the chair, fingers massaging his temples.
I don't like to do this, but I'll be honest with you.
You don't like being honest? Asked Martin, with one raised eyebrow.
Oh, no. I meant that I will be honest with you, but it is a somewhat long story. I don't like taking up any more of your valuable time.
Farnum offered a chagrined smile. Martin and Charles exchanged skeptical, raised eyebrow glances, but sat back down.
I believe the context is important, began Farnum. Permit me to digress a bit.
He took a deep breath.
The idea for the CRC began with discussions between myself, Maureen Clark, and her chief mechanic, Bob. They run that tourist attraction train ride up in Lincoln. They were lamenting how it was too bad that their 2 miles of track didn't connect to the main rail line. If it did, they could see using one of their steam locomotives to haul goods up and down the center of the state, using our state's abundant natural resources, wood as fuel. The federal folks couldn't cut that off with their siege. Their remarks were more commiseration than any sort of proposal, but it got me to thinking. What if we could connect the tracks and utilize their locomotive? I began researching what a project might require. I found that there was sufficient spare rail in the Lincoln area between the Clark's operation and the Hobo Railroad to span the 0.8 mile between the end of Clark's tracks and the northernmost end of the trunk railway. Enough, that is, if some sidings and unnecessary spurs were cannibalized. Still, there was enough rail to get the job done. Knowing that the connection was possible and rolling stock sufficient, I canvassed various landowners in the area to gauge their interest in cutting and selling their wood for food crops. There was more than enough interest. Several of them, especially the Pollard family, had stocks of wood cut last year, but no way to get them to any market. They located several old drag saws, the kind that were common before the invention of the chainsaw, and two-man saws, axes, and the like. They were certain they could produce enough wood to fill a 5-car train every couple of weeks. I was certain that communities in the South could provide surplus crops to trade. The Clarks, the Pollards, and myself established the Central Rail Collaborative this past May, and work began. We hired workers and started to lay rail atop the paved road that led to the railhead. I was about to embark on a recruiting trip to your fine farm country, when it seemed that the fates had woven a black thread into the fabric of our plans. The most major crisis was that the Clark's engine number 5, the one most suited to the daily runs of 100 miles, had a cracked cylinder head. She would run, but leaked steam badly, and barely had the power to pull a pair of empty cars. Their engine number 6 was in tip-top condition, but it was a logging engine. Wait, interrupted Martin. A logging engine? Don't they go really slow, like a truck stuck in first gear? Quite the case, continued Farnham. High torque at the expense of speed. Number 6 could not be CRC's regular engine. It would take upwards of 16 hours to go one way and would consume vast quantities of wood. Bob's plan was to have Number 6 tow Number 5 down to Manchester for repairs. You've probably heard that the city has been working on getting one of the 3 hydropower turbines in the Amiskig Dam back in service. Our plan was to use that voltage to power a larger welder and a vertical lathe to repair the cracked cylinder head.
So why do you need our welder? Asked Charles.
Sadly, the hydroelectric building is on the west side of the river. And the west side of Manchester is, I'm told, controlled by a difficult fellow named Vaquero. He has refused to allow work to continue until the city promises him most of the electric power generated. Negotiations are at an impasse, and the work has halted. Up in Lincoln, we have also run short on steel spacer rods to hold the tracks true to gauge. These are crucial to our new tracks' transit over pavement. There aren't enough spikes to ensure stability. More spacers need to be welded up for our last 200 yards. Our drag saws have some nifty little steam engines made from repurposed 2-cycle dirt bike engines. But 2 of our saws have broken several iterations of mechanical mountings. Their reciprocal forces are just too strong. They need proper welding. And then there are some modifications to the rolling stock that require welding. Sadly, our limited ability to weld in Lincoln has run out.
So you see, gentlemen, if we are to get the CRC in operation and get our economy moving, I need your help. New Hampshire needs your help. I may be able to locate some gasoline such that we might operate our little welder, but thus far I have come across no gasoline that has not spoiled. The CRC is a month behind schedule, and our summer crops are already ripening. I beg you not to turn me away, or to take undue advantage of my distress.
Let us discuss this a moment. Please excuse us, said Charles. He motioned for Martin to follow him into the barn. Once inside, Charles leaned over to glance out the barn door and make sure that Farnham and his driver were out of earshot.
Okay, this is a little awkward. He's actually begging us to do work for him.
What kind of negotiating tactic is that?
Is it some sort of salesman trick? Martin asked. You know, play the hardship card to make us feel bad for him so we'll cut him some slack?
Maybe. But we got nothing to lose. I mean, how much work do you guess he was talking about? 2 days?
Hard to say, but yeah, maybe.
You could get a lot of welding done in 2 days.
Notice that I said you?
Oh, give it up. You're as much part of this bargain as anyone. 2 days sounded about right to me, too. What about this? We say that we'll weld whatever he wants welded for 2 days max. That's it. Then we come back home. Make him triage what needs doing so it's not an endless game of scope creep. 2 days shouldn't throw us off at home too badly, right?
Martin stared with a slight frown.
2 days away might not ruin his plans, but these special projects had a bad habit of taking far longer than promised.
Okay, fine. 2 days. But what are you going to ask in exchange?
Charles frowned at the ground for a moment. How big is a boxcar?
Well, I don't know, complained Martin. Oh, come on. You knew about logging engines. You must have some idea.
Okay, hold on.
It was Martin's turn to stare at the ground. He had an H.O. Gage train set as a kid and was a total train nerd until he discovered that girls were much more interesting. He should know how big a boxcar was.
40 feet. That was the standard for a long time. 50s and 60s became common later.
Well, let's stick with 40, said Charles. They probably have old stuff anyhow. How wide inside?
8 feet was the standard.
Okay, 40 times 8 is 320 square feet of floor. Let's say they only stack it 4 feet high on account of being manually loaded.
Well, that would be 10 cords of wood per boxcar.
Well, how'd you figure that so fast?
Well, the sizes just worked out well for a cord of wood. 8 feet long by 4 feet wide by 4 feet tall. The car's 8 feet wide, stacked 4 feet high, you'd get a face cord. 40 feet long would be 10 sets of 4 feet, 10 cord.
Okay, Farnham said something about the train being 5 cars long. That would be 50 cord per trip. If we took a cut of 10%, that would be, 5 cord.
We're only working for 2 days, and we get 5 cord every time the train comes down?
You heard him. He's got other investors.
I don't think he's going to go for that.
I don't think he will either. But that's how haggling works. You start out with an outrageous offer so that your next really high offer sounds reasonable.
Martin shook his head. And maybe if you extract too high a price from a desperate man, he's forever resentful, instead of grateful, and looks for ways to cheat you every chance he gets.
Charles frowned. Okay. What about we ask him for 5%, but haggle down to 2? That would still be a cord of wood or so from each of their runs.
Martin nodded. They headed out of the barn.
Charles sauntered up to his cinder block and sat down.
Well, C.T., I think we might come to an agreement.
Excellent. Oh, that is excellent.
Farnham looked visibly relieved, like a father being told that his crippled child would walk again. Charles continued.
We'd like to clarify that we would be providing the CRC with 2 days of labor, welding whatever it is you have to be welded. 2 days. It'll be up to you to prioritize those tasks to fit into those 2 days.
Agreed, said Farnham.
And you provide the wood chips, added Martin.
Agreed. There are ample ships and scraps from the bucking and splitting.
For our services, we're thinking a 5% of each southbound haul would be fair.
Martin could see Charles's face set into a sort of resolve, anticipating objections and counteroffers.
That sounds reasonable, said Farnham. He stood and offered his hand for Charles to shake.
Charles blinked a few times and exhaled the lungful of air he had taken in for his counter-counter-offer. He stood to shake hands.
Good?
We'll draw up some papers to that effect when you arrive in Lincoln, said Farnham. I must ask you to keep the remuneration terms of our agreement strictly between ourselves. Few others will fully grasp the value of your work toward the success of the CRC. The human heart is very prone to jealousy, you know.
He waved to his driver, who then led the horse back onto the gravel driveway. The empty buggy wobbled over the patchy sod.
We have a couple of more stops to make before we head back up. Let's plan to meet in Lincoln in 4 days. Yourselves, your truck, and your welder. My office is in the yellow caboose, with Central Rail lettered on the side. It is on the siding along Railroad Street. You can't miss it.
Farnham stepped into the buggy. It tilted noticeably and settled onto its springs.
I'll see you gentlemen in 4 days. It has been a pleasure doing business with you. Oh, and take some care as you pass by Plymouth. There are some hooligans there. Keep up your speed and don't stop for any reason.
He waved. The driver said,
Yep,
and flapped the reins. The horse flinched, then pulled eagerly. The buggy's pale green awning disappeared down the hill to the clip-clop-clip hoofbeats of a trot.
That was too easy, said Martin.
He had the same sinking feeling he often felt after agreeing to be part of one of Charles's great ideas.
Another deal. Being an entrepreneur involves taking the risk that a possible gold mine could turn out to be a pit of quicksand. Martin is more prone to see the quicksand than the gold, but he isn't totally risk-averse, though he's also not super confident either. I'd like to give a belated shout-out to Anne and Jeff and Annie and Evan, as well as Jessica, for having bought me coffees on Buy Me a Coffee. I'm a little behind on thanking you all publicly, but I'm trying to get caught up. Thanks, too, to all of you new followers on Podbean. I hope you're liking what you're hearing. If you are, consider buying me a cup of virtual coffee like the nice folks I just mentioned. Support from you listeners is what keeps this podcast going. To be honest, ad revenue sure isn't. Up next week will be another Doom Chat with Jeff and Brian. This time, our topic is Econo-Doom, Surviving Economic Collapses. They will be reviewing the books Patriots by John Wesley Rawls and Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. I'll be reviewing The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. What can we learn from popular fiction about economic collapses, as well as what we can learn from a couple of real ones? That's next week. I'll talk to you then.